Let me get started. Good morning, and welcome to today's WISCAPES Forum on the Funding and Accountability in Public Higher Education. For those of you who know me, I'm not Julie Underwood, the Dean of the School of Ed, but I'm Noel Berdomsky, the Director and Associate Researcher at WISCAPE. Today's forum continues WISCAPE's series of programs examining the evolving relationship among the public university, the state, and the federal governments, and the citizens they are entrusted to serve. This area of scholarship is critical to the sustainability and longevity of public higher education in Wisconsin and the country as a whole. In recent years, issues of funding and accountability have taken center stage in debates about public higher education. In Wisconsin, and most other states, legislatures are struggling to balance funding for higher education with the climbing costs of Medicaid and other public services. And in Wisconsin, we still don't have a state budget approved, last in the nation. Meanwhile, public universities look for other sources of revenue in order to make up the difference and continue to fulfill their ever-expanding and multifaceted missions. Universities like UW-Madison increasingly rely on federal and private grants, tuition and fees, alumni funding, and business endeavors. As a result, these institutions must meet greater expectations and demands from a wider variety of constituent groups. In Wisconsin, these pressures are further complicated by our current budget crisis. The impasse in the state legislature has crippled state government and, in turn, the many agencies that rely on funding and support. In a hostile and sometimes questionable climate, public higher education battles other interests for scarce funding from the legislature. Meanwhile, legislators and the public cry for more accountability from institutions. To help assess the current situation and propose solutions for the future, WISCAPE has brought together four higher education experts. Using recent scholarship, these scholars will explore how states benefit from investing in higher education, how to maximize this investment of tax dollars, and how universities can serve the public good and ensure stable state funding. Phil Trostel will start our discussion by providing evidence of the substantial fiscal benefits governments receive for investing in higher education and how few, if any, other public investments can match its return. Following his presentation, Ed St. John will discuss how states can best fund higher education to optimize desirable education outcomes, such as ensuring access, maintaining quality, and optimizing tax dollars. His discussion of the Indiana 21st Century Scholars Program will be especially informative for the newly emerging Wisconsin Covenant. After a lunch break, David Wirtz will refocus our conversation by presenting his emerging research of state and institutional factors that have influenced levels of state support for public higher education over the past 20 years. To conclude the day, King Alexander will unveil a new national policy proposal for accountability designed to measure and finance a true institutional commitment to public needs. These four scholars will take the dialogue beyond a simple debate over dollars and degrees and encourage each of us to reconsider the roles of universities, governments, and the public in the supporting and preserving the quality of American public higher education. With that, let me introduce you the first speaker, Dr. Phil Trostel. But before the introduction, a few announcements. We will have a host of information from today's events, including policy briefs, working papers, and copies of the PowerPoint presentations available on our website in the upcoming weeks. You can also contact our office to borrow a DVD recording of today's presentations. And now the introduction. To help start our discussion this morning, it is my pleasure to introduce Phil Trostel, a professor of economics and public policy in the Department of Economics and Margaret Chase Smith Center for Public Policy at the University of Maine, and a WISCAPE faculty affiliate. And I hope I can say a a dear friend. Professor Trostel joined the University of Maine faculty in 2001 after holding professorships at North Carolina State University, Hong Kong University, University of Warwick, and Dartmouth College. He received his PhD in economics from Texas A&M University in 91. Professor Trostel's interest in the economics of higher education is illustrated by his extensive publications in the field, including articles such as Does Public Investment in Higher Education Pay for States? Should Education Be Publicly Provided? And Should Education Be Subsidized? While visiting Madison last fall as a Wiscape visiting scholar, Professor Trostel co-taught a graduate course entitled The Economics of State Support for Higher Education. He did that with President Emeritus Catherine Lyle. Professor Trostel has spoken at two previous Wiscape events, and we are extremely pleased, and I am extremely pleased, to have him here again. His presentation today, there it is titled What the Government Gets from Investing in College Students. Please join me in welcoming Phil Trostel.
Thank you, Noel. Well, first I would like to thank Wiscape for bringing me out again. It's always a pleasure to be here, especially this time of year. I really have a great time every time I come. For those of you who are my age or older, you might remember a very effective ad campaign. I think it started back in the 1970s. I'm not sure when it stopped, but I couldn't find it on the internet, but I did find a magazine ad. This was the United Negro College Fund's ad campaign that always ended with, "A mind is a terrible thing to waste." It was a brilliant campaign. And what I'm going to be talking about today is essentially this. A mind that is prevented from going to college for whatever reason is a waste in lots of dimensions. And the dimensions I want to emphasize today are different than what they were emphasizing in the ads. So they were emphasizing lost technologies that aren't happening because of minds who aren't trained. But there's also many ways, and most of these we already know. For those who get more education on average, there's higher income, lower unemployment, better health, longer life. These are some of the private benefits. There's also various social benefits such as lower crime, faster innovation, increased civic participation, and so on. But the dimension I want to emphasize today, has already been hinted at, is the fiscal impact. And this is not something that, it's fairly obvious once you think about it, but it's not something that enters into the debate on why the public should be involved in higher education. That investment in college students is quite different than many other sorts of things that the government can invest in, like roads, fire protection, disease protection, and so on, that investing in higher education creates direct fiscal benefits. In addition to the other benefits, which aren't so direct, so to the extent that higher education leads to faster growth, it also creates fiscal benefits. Those are the things I'm not going to emphasize. The things I'm going to emphasize are the direct fiscal consequences of government investment in higher education. And the conclusion is that even just from our own narrow interest as taxpayers, even if there's no other reason why we cared about public involvement in higher education, it's a great investment from that angle alone. So. The conclusion, to jump right to it, is a mind is indeed a terrible thing to waste in many dimensions, and I'm going to show you in some detail one of those dimensions. So what I'm doing here is, this is a research study that I've just completed. I've been working on this for quite a while, and I've actually talked about some of this even the first time I came here to speak about 3 or 4 years ago. But now I can speak with more authority about some of these impacts. So I'm complementing some other literature. There's a huge literature showing the private monetary return to college education that the estimates, there's some variation, but it appears that the private monetary rate of return to investment education is about 10%. And that's above the rate of inflation. That's a real rate of return. There's also a fairly, well, much more recent, but becoming fairly large literature documenting some of the other benefits of higher education, like longer life, plus a lot of the social benefits like civic participation, volunteering, and so on, lower crime. But there's not much that's quantified the physical impact. And in fact, this is the list. As far as I know, these are all the studies which have really tried to look at the physical impacts of investment in higher education. Two of these in particular, the one by Cromp and Bernays, those are really one study, just two incarnations. And there might be some others, but as far as I know, this is about the whole list. And I put up here that this literature is rather piecemeal and superficial. And I feel a bit comfortable in saying that because I've written much of some of that stuff. And really, most of this, except for the one by Cromp and Bernays, really is very basic. And so what I'm trying to do in this study is really look at this much more detail, much more carefully, and see if the initial results, which suggest a very high physical return, are indeed valid. So just to give you the summary of what I'm doing, this trying to extend this small literature, I've done a number of things. I'm trying to quantify just about all the important direct physical impacts, not just some of them. Most of that literature just focuses on one or two, like greater tax revenues, and that's the biggie. But there are all sorts of other physical benefits, as we'll see. Another issue which only the Cromp and Bernays study has done is looked at the timing of the fiscal benefits, which matters quite a bit because the timing, the investment occurs initially, but a lot of the payoffs don't occur until a long time later. I use a better data set. I separate the state fiscal effects from the federal fiscal effects. I estimate the effects from different types of degrees. Almost all of that literature focuses on bachelor's degrees. So I look at master's degrees and associate's degrees and so forth. Another issue, as you'll see, is pretty important, is I look at the public cost. How much is the government investing per degree, which is kind of a tricky issue, and that small literature hasn't looked at that before. And finally, I calculate the rate of return on that investment, which that previous literature hasn't done either. And let me stress, though, that I'm only looking at the direct fiscal impact. And there's all sorts of other benefits. Well, I mean, some of these are pretty obvious, but one of these other benefits that I'm not quantifying here is the indirect effect on tax revenues and expenditures through creating faster economic growth. In addition, I'm not including any benefits from that we might get from university research, so the knowledge creation, not looking at that. Service and extension activities, I'm not including any benefits from that. Graduates from private colleges, I'm not including those benefits either, or from the extent that college and or higher education and college graduates create job creation and so forth. So it's a fairly narrow study. I'm just looking at one specific benefit, not that it's the most important one, but just one that I could feel comfortable in quantifying fairly well. Also, as opposed to some other literature which is a little bit similar, which I'll mention in a second, I'm not looking at any of the other social benefits that I mentioned a little bit earlier. So the study that I've done is similar to some of the work that you might have seen on the benefits of preschool interventions. And there's also some more recent work looking at the fiscal impacts of and other benefits from high school completion. This is narrower than those studies, and I'm only looking at the direct fiscal impacts, not any of the other social benefits. So you can't compare this directly to, say, the estimated return to the Perry Preschool Project, because they include all sorts of other social benefits, like the value we get from lower crime. I'm not including those things. I want to spend a few minutes talking about exactly how I went about constructing my estimates so you can see what the limitations are. And it turns out it's a little bit more complicated than I even first thought. And so I want you to give you some idea of how reliable these estimates might be or might not be. The data that I use mostly is the current population survey. This is the main demographic data set that's used in the U.S. for computing things like the official unemployment rate in the country and in individual states. It's a very large sample of individuals. I'm only looking at those who are 79 and younger. This gives me about, and I'm only focusing on those, on the outcomes after high school, so I started at age 19, which gives me a sample of 138,000 individuals per year. So it's a fairly large sample, which allows me to do some things which wasn't done in the previous literature, like quantify the impacts in individual states. I have a large enough sample to get reasonable precision at the state level. Most of the time I'm looking at data from 2005, and a few instances I look at a few years of data, but in any event, everything's converted to $2,005 dollars. The CPS measures education attainment in terms of degrees. So the emphasis of this study is on the impact from degrees. That's not my choice. That's simply dictated by the data. I think it might be make more sense to look at the impact of college credits, but I don't have data on that. And I combine the professional and doctorate degrees, but I need to skip through some of this methodology stuff. Let me first go with the typical approach to give you a flavor of what I'm doing and also to point out some of the ways that this simple approach can be extended. The first thing that's done in this literature is to look at income differentials. So the following figure shows you for people within the ages of 25 to 64, this shows you the average income levels of these different qualifications. These are high school graduates. I'm not sure if you could read this in the back. So those are some college, associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's, and professional and doctorate. And this is pretty well known. You get higher income with higher levels of education. And we identify from that the earnings premium. So, for example, a bachelor's degree, their earnings premium is, from this data, is $24,264, which is about double the high school, the average earnings of an average high school graduate with no college. So the pink here identifies the earnings premium. For professional and doctorate degrees, there's a further earnings premium above the bachelor's degree. The premium is relative to bachelor's degree because that's the prerequisite for the advanced degree. And again, these guys make about twice what your average bachelor's degree holder makes. And from that, we can use an estimate of the average tax rate. And the average tax rate is that, let me first look just for simplicity at just at state and local tax revenues. State and local tax revenues are about 11% of personal income. So if we apply 11% to those earnings premium, we get the following fiscal premium, $621 per year for those with some college and no degree, and so on. So an average bachelor's degree holder pays $2,265 more in state and local taxes per year. And over a 40-year work career, that adds up to a lot of money. Of course, this is only one of the benefits from college attainment, and I'll talk about some of the other ones like federal income taxes and that sort of thing. But obviously, this is simplistic, and there's a number of complicating factors, which I'll now touch on some of those. The first is about timing. There's a number of complications about timing, and I talked about this already. These returns are occurring in the future, and in present value, they have a lower value because you could earn, if we were to use those resources elsewhere, you'd earn some return on that. So if we discount this, over a 40-year career, that $2,200-and-some-odd, which I don't recall, is $106,600 over a 40-year work career. So a pretty sizable fiscal impact, but in present value, that's about two-thirds of that, or a little bit less than that, $63,000 in present value, using a 3% discount rate, which is kind of common in applied economics work. That's believed to be roughly the real rate of return above the rate of, or the rate of return above the rate of inflation, risk-free rate of return. This is the present value at age 25, but the costs clearly are going to, or at least for most college students, occurs before then. So if we were to account for that, the present value would be even lower. And also, college students will be paying lower taxes while they're in college, and we need to take account of that too. And finally, another complication that practically all the previous literature doesn't address is that the earnings premium, and therefore the fiscal premium, is not constant over a life cycle. The following picture will show you the average paths of earnings over the life cycle. So the black here shows you, on average, what earnings looks like for a bachelor's degree holder. And the blue shows you the average income profile for your high school graduate with no college. And you probably, can you see this in the back? I guess this didn't turn out too well, but I'll trace it with my finger. The earnings premium goes like this. That the earnings premium reaches a maximum at around 45, late 40s, but it's much smaller than that, dramatically smaller than that, when college graduates are first coming out. So the earnings premium at age in the late 40s is about $30,000, but for right coming out of college, the earnings premium is only about $10,000. And in taking into account the present value of this, it makes a lot of difference because you get the big impact way down here, not initially coming out of college. But it's pretty straightforward to take that into account. Now, a more complicated issue is that you have different paths for different students. That some students take 8 years to graduate, they cram 4 years of college into eight. Other students, breeze right through. And initially I tried to take this into account by looking at the average length of degree, and ultimately I decided that created too much uncertainty. So for what I've done in this study is narrow the interpretation. That the fiscal benefits that I'm going to quantify are the fiscal impacts we get from a traditional college student who goes straight to college right out of high school and graduates in the normal number of years. When I tried to account for the average length of degree, that means you also have to account for the taxes they pay while in college, because presumably the reason why some students cram 4 years of college into eight is because they're working part-time. So what I've done is I've assumed we have traditional students who they bring in their work career at 19 for high school graduates, 21 for associate degree holders, 23 for bachelor's degree holders, and so on. And for professional and doctorate degrees, again, I'm assuming they're going straight through to get their degrees. To be honest, the reason I did that is just because it's just too messy to try to account for what's happening to the average college student, because you have to account for both their taxes they're paying while they're in college and also the fact that they're taking longer. I assume that students have no fiscal impact while they're in college. Which, the way I quantified that, I'm assuming they're paying no taxes while they're in college. And the amount of social insurance payments that they receive, like in terms of welfare-type programs or Medicaid, is the same as before an average college. And being more specific about that, if we take, say, a person with a master's degree, I assume that the amount of social insurance payments they receive while they're in college in their freshman year at 19 is the average amount that a high school diploma holder receives at 19. And it gradually is declining, well, because it declines in college attainment. And so at age 21, I impute the average social insurance payments as being the average for an associate degree holder at age 21. So it creates a gradually declining assumption about the social insurance payments. And I have to do that because of the data, which doesn't tell me how much social insurance payments college students are receiving. It just tells, I don't really know for sure if they're a college student or not. So the implication of that is pretty obvious, that clearly there are a lot of students who are taking longer than the normal number of years to graduate. So my method is overstating the present value of those fiscal benefits to the extent that students are taking longer to graduate. So we're pushing those fiscal benefits out. On the other hand, I'm also ignoring the fact that students are clearly paying at least some taxes while they're in college, that you have to at least pay some sales taxes while you're in college. And I'm assuming that college students pay no taxes whatsoever. So I'm trying to balance it in the other direction. So on the other hand, I'm understating the present value of the benefits, and so I'm hoping that they roughly offset each other. Whether they do or not, that I can't really tell you, but that's about all I could do with the data. So for three reasons, the approach I've just outlined understates the fiscal benefits, and I'll actually talk about some more reasons later, but in terms of timing, for three reasons, this understates the fiscal benefits. First, I'm going to ignore those who have some college but no degree. And the reason why I have to do that is it's difficult. I'm trying to match the cost per degree to the return per degree. But how do we know how many some college people we're getting for that payment, for that investment. So I'm ignoring those who have some college, and these people do earn more. In fact, the simplistic fiscal premium, annual fiscal premium I showed you earlier was $621. So I'm ignoring that group entirely. I'm also going to ignore the fact that college graduates generally live longer and therefore create these fiscal benefits for a longer period of time. And finally, I'm ignoring any intergenerational impacts, which are also going to be substantial because children of parents with college degrees are much more likely to get a college degree and therefore create the same sort of fiscal impacts that I'm going to be showing you. So wherever possible, I tried to be as conservative as I could in showing the fiscal impacts. Another issue which turns out to be fairly easy to address is that tax rates are not constant with income. The simplistic approach that I showed you earlier just assumed a constant average tax rate. Beginning in 2005, the current population survey has estimates of federal income taxes, federal payroll taxes, state and local taxes, and so on for these individuals. So this is one of the reasons why I have a better data set than in the previous literature. This has only been available for the last couple of years. I also use some other data to compute sales tax rates across income levels. Now let me briefly touch on a couple issues which could be very important in trying to quantify the return to public investment in higher education. What about causation? It's not necessarily the case that those with a college degree are earning more because they went to college. It could be the case that these are just smarter people to begin with. And this has been a fairly substantial issue in the economics of education for a long time. Let me just skip through these. So there's been a lot of research which has tried to establish the causation from education and the subsequent earnings, and also not just earnings, but the causal effect of education on longer lives, better health, and so forth. This literature is fairly consistently, although maybe not always, has showed that these, also crime here, that despite the fact that it seems very plausible that at least part of the reason why people with higher education earn more is because they're smarter to begin with, the evidence doesn't suggest that the ordinary correlation is misleading at all. In fact, a lot of the estimates trying to identify the causal effect find higher impacts or a higher causal effect of education on earnings and these other outcomes than the simple correlation. I could talk about reasons about that, but I think I better move on. Another issue that's implicit in what I've been doing is that there's an assumption that the earnings premium is constant, no matter how many college graduates we have. And if you think about this in the supply and demand framework, in fact, people have talked about this in the supply and demand framework, that as more people get a college degree, we're increasing the supply of college graduates, presumably that's going to drive down the earnings premium. In fact, this is something that was talked about in the 70s in a well-known book that was predicting that because so many more people were getting a college degree at that time, that the earnings premium of college graduates was going to decline, but that didn't happen. That the return to a college education is no lower now than it was in the 1970s. In fact, it's a little bit higher, that in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there's a pretty marked increase in the earnings premium, despite the fact that more people were getting college degrees. There's been some research about this. I won't go into that, but I've done some of this research, and if there is any effect, it's tiny. That even at the individual, we could talk about it at the federal level, or at the national level, we could talk about it at the state level, even for individual states that have more college graduates, the earnings premium is not smaller. Or if it is, it's infinitesimally small. Another complication is introduced by migration of college graduates, the so-called brain drain idea. And you hear this often in policy in policy issues, is that we could invest a lot in educating our young people, but then they're just going to move to Chicago. So these fiscal impacts that I'm going to show you, we're not going to receive them. So there's a fiscal externality which undermines individual states' incentives to support higher education. I did a recent study on this, and I found that the extent of the interstate migration of college graduates is probably a lot lower than is commonly believed. And what I did in this earlier work is looked at net migration rates of college graduates and found that the loss of college graduates, bachelor's graduates to other states is about 7% on average. For associate's degrees and master's degrees, well, for associate's degrees it's less than that. For the advanced degrees, it's a little bit higher than that. And so I'll build these estimates in to my corresponding state estimates later on. That'll reduce the fiscal impacts in individual states by the extent of this leakage of college graduates. Skip through that. Now, finally, one last issue I want to talk about before I actually get into the numbers is what about the causal effect of public support for education, which is different than the causal effect of higher education on these earnings premia. That it might not be the case that we could put more money into higher education and we get correspondingly more graduates. Something Professor Hansen could talk about is the fact that a lot of college graduates are receiving a public subsidy going to a public university, but they probably would have gone to college anyway. So there's not a causal effect of public support on college education, at least for non-poor families. So a lot of the subsidies to higher education, that is the lower tuition, it's high-income families who are taking advantage of that, not just those who are on the margin of college attendance. So the implication of that is that the marginal impact of public support for higher education might be a lot less than the average impact. This is something that my next research project is going to be trying to look at that issue more carefully, but there was a study that was actually a working paper that was published last year that provides evidence on this. And this is the study I'm referring to is by Bound and Turner. They look at increases in the relative number of potential college students in a state, which is the number of high school graduates in the state. And how does that impact both funding for higher education per student and the number of degrees that we get 4 years later? And they found that as you get more, relatively more high school graduates coming in to, or potentially coming into the college system, that funding per student falls by about 40%. That funding goes up, but it doesn't go up as much as the number of new college students or potential college students. At the same time, you get the number of degrees awarded 4 years later goes down by about 40%. So it suggests, at least tentatively, that there's a proportionate impact of public funding on the number of public degrees 4 years later. So it at least is suggestive that the causal effect of public support is the marginal effect is about the same as the average effect. Anyway, as I said, this is something that I'm going to look into more detail, but this is, I think, the biggest weakness right now in the results that I'll show you. Can you see these numbers back there? Okay, I'll just tell you what they say. The first table that I have here shows you the earnings, the fiscal premium in state and local taxes. And we have here the average high school graduate pays about $34,000 in state and local taxes over their lifetime. The average college graduate with a bachelor's degree pays a little less than $90,000 per year in state and local taxes. Over their lifetime. So almost a 3-to-1 difference. For a professional and doctorate degree holder, they pay $168,000 a year in state and local taxes. I also look at it for property taxes. You can't see that. That's a lot flatter. There's not much of a fiscal premium there. For sales taxes, it's kind of in between the income tax case and the property tax case. And then finally, I total them up. And the number that I get for, the fiscal premium in state and local taxes for a bachelor's degree is over their lifetime is $118,000. So it's a pretty sizable chunk. The next one is for federal taxes. These numbers are a lot bigger. The average high school graduate pays over their lifetime $111,000 in income taxes. The average college graduate pays $367,000 in federal income taxes over their lifetime. For a professional and doctorate degree, it's $733,000 over their lifetime in income taxes. There's also large premia in a premium in the payroll tax as well. And you add up these, well, I'll just skip through, I'll get to them at the end. On the expenditure side, there's a number of complications. The things that I quantify are Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, Supplemental Security, unemployment, workers' compensation, public cash assistance, food stamps, housing subsidies, energy assistance, and school lunches. I could put dollar values on those differences by education attainment. I also have data, but not dollar data, on the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children. So I document that difference, but I don't quantify it in terms of dollars. Transportation assistance, child care assistance, and so forth. The benefits that I'll show for Medicaid and Medicare are measured as their insurance value, not the actual amount of health care they're receiving through those programs. Here are the results for welfare. Again, I know you can't see this, but total welfare payments for your average high school graduate is a little bit less than $15,000 a year over their lifetime. For your average bachelor's graduate, it's a little over $3,000. So again, a pretty big difference in relative terms, but these numbers aren't nearly as dramatic as the taxes. I'm always showing the effects here for food stamps because that's the biggest program. And again, the numbers that I have here are on the conservative side because I'm not including a couple programs like Women, Infants, and Children. But still, compared to taxes, that's not all that big. Here we have Medicaid. These numbers are a lot larger because the Medicaid program is a lot larger than the other welfare programs. So for your average high school diploma holder with no college, the lifetime value of their Medicaid benefits is a little over $42,000. For a bachelor's degree holder, it's $19,000. Here I have Medicare. Again, I know you can't see this, but the relative differences across levels of education attainment are pretty small. That your average high school graduate, the amount of Medicare they receive is pretty close to the amount that your average bachelor's degree holder receives. But because this is such a big program, you still get fairly large numbers in terms of the differentials. It's a big program, relatively small differences lead to some reasonably large fiscal premium. Let me skip through some of these issues, and let me just point out that there are lots of reasons why the numbers that I'm discussing are very conservative. Whenever possible, if there was uncertainty, I went the more conservative route in showing the fiscal benefits. Let me skip through this. Here we have Social Security. Again, it's similar to the pattern, similar as for Medicare. The amounts received are relatively the same, or pretty close to each other. But because this is such a big program, small differences lead to relatively large numbers. So again, there are fiscal premia in Social Security, mainly because those with more education are retiring later. So particularly in present value, that makes a fairly substantial difference. Pardon? Okay, for Medicare, the premium for a bachelor's degree is a little less than $4,000. The premium for a professional and doctorate compared to a bachelor's degree?
I can't see it at all. I just want the totals.
The totals for the individual categories? Let me come back to that. Because I do have a table at the end where I try to summarize this. Because one of the things that makes this difficult is we have different degrees.
$42,000 to $19,000 you gave for Medicaid. What's the comparable figures for Medicaid?
Okay. In terms of the fiscal premium, it's going to be smaller though, and the reason why is that for Medicare and Social Security, the amounts received are fairly equal, doesn't depend that much on education attainment. But because these are such big programs, even though you have a small difference, it leads to a relatively large number. So the value for Medicaid for a bachelor's degree holder, the premium was $23,000. The $19,000 that I mentioned was the average amount that they received. The $23,000 is how much less that is than the $42,000 that the average high school diploma holder receives.
I'm sorry I'm being so difficult, but I like the gross numbers. I can net them out myself.
Okay. Well, I could supply the paper for you later so we could avoid these sorts of difficulties. Because part of the problem is we have different degrees. The premium's not the same for every degree. But anyway, be happy to supply all those numbers later on. One of the more interesting ones is the fiscal premium that we get in corrections. That I estimated that the average amount we spend on corrections per prisoner is a little less than $30,000. And there are substantial differences in the incidence of incarceration across education attainment. For your average bachelor's degree holder, a little over 0.1% of that group is incarcerated. So a little less than 1 in 1,000 bachelor's degree holders are in prison. For those with an associate's degree or some college, it's 0.32%. For your average high school diploma holder, the incarceration rate is 1.19%. So in other words, more or less than 1 out of every 100 people with a high school diploma are in jail. And again, we're not talking about high school dropouts here, we're talking about high school graduates. And so the difference in the incidence of incarceration is 10.4 comparing high school to a BA or higher. And so applying these estimates of incarceration rates, which comes from another study done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, to the $30,000 cost per prisoner gives us some pretty substantial fiscal premium of $321 per year for a bachelor's degree. Of course, add that up over a number of years, that adds up to a fairly large number. The fiscal premium for a bachelor's degree is $19,000 over their lifetime. And again, I'd be very happy to supply the paper, which you can see the specific numbers, because I know I'm giving you a lot of numbers very quickly. One last one that I look at is the public health care costs that come from the lack of any health insurance. No private health insurance, or no Medicare or no Medicaid. And a study done a few years ago estimated the public cost, the government cost, per uninsured person, and that was $823 per year. So this is another way we pay in terms of health costs in addition to Medicaid and Medicare. I use the CPS data to document the extent of having no insurance, no private insurance or Medicaid. And, let me go back to that one. For your average high school diploma holder, 16.8% of that population doesn't have any health insurance. And this is those who are 19 and older. For bachelor's degree, 8.3% of that population does not have any health insurance. For master's degree, it goes down to 5% and so forth. Applying that $823 public cost per uninsured gives us the fiscal premium that I show here. For a bachelor's degree, that adds up to about $5,000 over their lifetime. So it's not a huge impact, but it adds to the rest of those. I'll better speed things up here. The most problematic part of this whole thing was quantifying the public cost per degree. And I'm using data on the public costs coming from national income and product accounts. That one problem with that is it gives you expenditures that are financed through public university endowments. And you can make an argument that, wait a minute, that's not really a state government contribution. You could go either way on that. I decided to go the more conservative route. So endowment revenues are counted as a public contribution. I'm also including all the costs of university research and service. So all the monies going into higher education are counted as a cost in producing degrees. Data from the National Center for Education Statistics suggests that Research is 19.3% of total education and general expenditures. And again, I think that's pretty conservative, but I'm ignoring that. On the other hand, the data I have are only for current expenditures. It doesn't include capital expenditures. Some other data suggests that capital expenditures are 13.5% of operating expenditures. So I don't account for either of those. These are roughly offsetting. This one's a little bit bigger than that one. The difference is 6-something percent. I'm not going to account for that. The more problematic issue, or perhaps the most problematic issue, is what do we do with graduates from private colleges? Now, they're not getting any money through financing the colleges, but a lot of those people are getting financial aid. And we can't disentangle at least the federal part of money going to those students, those who are in private colleges versus those who are in public colleges. So I make, again, the conservative assumption that any monies going to graduates from private colleges, I ignore those additional degrees. Or in other words, the assumption is that federal financial aid going to private students doesn't lead to more degrees. So again, I've tried to be conservative. I take the total public cost divided by the number of graduates from private colleges only. I'm sorry, public colleges only. And that makes a big difference. If I were to make that relative to the number of total graduates, we'd get a substantially lower cost per degree. And in terms of leading, ultimately going to a rate of return calculation, it makes a huge difference. Let me skip through these, except for to tell you that in the following results, I take the weighted average fiscal premium. That I'm taking the weighted average of the associate's degree premium, the bachelor's degree premium, and so forth, so I can account for all the different degrees. And the reason why I have to do that is that my costs are for all the different degrees. I don't have the cost per bachelor's graduate. I have the cost per, well, just the total cost. And I have the total number of degrees, but I can't split up the cost in degrees that are associates. So very generous cost calculation is that the cost per degree is $74,500. Averaged over all degrees. Now, that probably, if for those of you who are familiar with the amount of state funding per student, that seems pretty high. State funding per student is, you know, less than $10,000 a year. Four-year degrees suggest that the public contribution is only $35,000 a year. But making all these various conservative assumptions, we get a much bigger number. If I were to divide the total government cost by all college graduates, including those from private colleges, we get $48,000 as opposed to a little less than $75,000. So here are my bottom line estimates where I take the weighted average of the different degrees. The fiscal premium in state and local taxes is $118,000 over a lifetime. For federal income taxes, it's $237,000 over a lifetime. For federal payroll taxes, it's $115,000 over a lifetime. So that's the fiscal impact we get per degree on a four-year equivalence scale. I also do that for the various expenditure categories. All these things are negative because we're creating expenditure savings. They add up to a little less than $85,000 over a lifetime. So the cost per degree, generously, is $75,000. Just in expenditure savings alone, we get $85,000 in benefits. Or in other words, spending goes down for each degree we have. That we're saving more in other programs than we are on actually financing higher education on a per student basis. The total tax revenues we get are $471,000 per degree. So the total of this and this is $556,000 per degree. Compare that to a $75,000 cost, the ratio is 7.5 to 1. For every dollar going to higher education, we get 7.5 times the fiscal benefits. The internal rate of return on that, can't see it, I know, is 10.3%. That's the average fiscal rate of return on that investment. And again, I have conservative assumptions throughout this calculation. The costs are generous, the various fiscal benefits I try to be as conservative as possible. If we were to include the private graduates, that number goes up to 13.7%. So it makes a big difference on what I'm assuming or what I should do with private college graduates. This chart shows you the time path of the total of these fiscal benefits. That when they graduate, we have a fiscal cost of $75,000 a year. $75,000 total. Then they start recovering it, and we reach the break-even point at age 31 and a half. So for your traditional college graduate who starts working at 23, it takes 9.5 years to recover that investment after graduation, and then it keeps to going up until it reaches $480,000. So the net impact over a lifetime per four-year equivalent degree is $481,000. I also estimated this at the benefits going to individual states. I'll skip through that because I think I'm already over time.
Okay.
How long do I have?
We'll take questions at about 10:30 to 10:35.
So I have 1 minute.
5 minutes.
Okay, sorry. I'm almost done. Here are the average state and local benefits. It turns out, let me refer to my numbers here, that most of the fiscal benefits go to the federal government, federal income taxes, and also there's a lot of the expenditure savings occur to the federal government. Here are my numbers. Of the total fiscal benefits of $561,000 per degree, 72.5% go to the federal government. While the federal government contributes a little less than 19% of the total cost. So most of the funding is at the state and local level, most of the benefits go to the federal government. So when we look at the benefits at the state level, they're a lot smaller. The total expenditure savings is $33,000 over a lifetime. The total additional taxes are a little less than $110,000 over a lifetime. So they're the state and local government contribution per degree is, I think, about $60,000, $60,500. So at the state level, the benefit ratio is 2.35 to 1. For every dollar put in at the state and local government level, the total fiscal payoff over a lifetime is 2.3 times that amount. The internal rate of return that we get from the state perspective is 3.1%, which is still a pretty healthy return. That's an after-inflation rate of return at the individual state level. So it's a lot smaller than the total, but still, because these numbers are so large, it's still a pretty healthy rate of return. I should point out that the numbers I've reported here are adjusted downward slightly to account for the net migration of college graduates. That states don't keep all their college graduates, so we take that into account and reduce these numbers slightly. And so these numbers take that into account. I've also done it for Wisconsin. We could talk about that later. It turns out that, let me just conclude with where I started with. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. The analogy I like to use is that it's like, economists often talk about $100 bills lying on the ground. And when economists use this analogy, they're trying to explain how markets work. That where there's a profitable opportunity, typically people will take advantage of that. That if you see $100 lying on the ground, pick it up. This is very much like a $100 bill lying on the ground waiting to be picked up. And to be more specific, each college graduate that we aren't getting is like a $481,000 bill lying on the ground. And that's just, again, the direct fiscal impact. So there's the total fiscal benefits are $556,000. The cost is a little less than $75,000, so we get that's where the $481,000 comes from. If we want to just put that in present value instead of just the totals, even in present value, and again, I'm using a 3% real discount rate, each person not getting a college degree is $182,000 lying on the ground waiting to be picked up. So instead of rushing to pick up these $481,000 bills, state funding for higher education is a falling priority. In 1984, 4.1% of state spending was in higher education. In 1994, it had fallen to 2.4%. And in 2004, the latest year of data that I have, it had fallen further to 1.8%. So that's the thought I'll leave you with.
Obviously, we built in time for questions. So if there's any questions or comments, and you've got to wait till I run to catch you.
Because
so we, oh, not on the, not with technology. Hold on.
Your data is extremely persuasive. Your arguments are clear. How do we package what you have for us so that it makes a difference to the state legislators in Wisconsin and to the federal government? How do we get, I mean, the data is sort of overwhelming, but yet, as you show right at the end, it's not changing anything. So it's not getting through. How do we communicate what you have developed so that it can make a difference for our state legislature, which of course is of serious concern right at the moment, but also to the federal government?
There's a number of things I could say about that. First, we could document these things thoroughly, like I've tried to do. Another idea I have, which is really probably crazy, is we should introduce a taxpayer bill of rights to pick up these $481,000 bills. We talk about taxpayer bill of rights to reduce the tax burden, and we talk about constraining government spending. From a taxpayer's point of view, we need to put our money there just so I could pay less taxes. So let's, instead of being opponents of Tabor, let's propose our own. That's my own quirky idea.
Other questions?
There's one down here.
Yeah. Or comments? Oh, hold on.
Isn't one implication of this that we should raise tuition and reduce the state costs, and this would raise the rate of return by a large, large amount?
You're correct that if we were to reduce tuition, deny people getting a college degree, we would raise the rate of return, the average rate of return. But the goal is not to have the highest rate of return.
No.
The goal is when you see $481,000 lying on the ground, pick it up. I mean, if the costs or the benefits outweigh the cost, you pick it up. You aren't trying to maximize the rate of return.
Well, but I'm a state legislator, and you've made this great case. All this money is lying on the ground. We can pick it up as a state legislature by raising tuition on the assumption that enrollments will not drop dramatically.
Right. Well, yeah, okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
So in fact, the legislators would love this, in contrast to making a better case for more spending. This would say, cut the spending.
Well, this goes back to one of the issues I raised earlier on about the causal effect of public support on degree attainment. And the one study I mentioned, I think very persuasively demonstrates that public support does lead to more degrees. That in the study by Pound and Turner, you have a natural experiment going on. If you have more potential degrees coming into the system, funding doesn't go up by as much, so funding per student falls. And we also get fewer degrees by about the same proportion.
Well, all I would say is that tuition here has gone up substantially in the last decade or two. Has the number of degrees fallen off?
That's a good point.
Probably not.
No, it hasn't. I wouldn't think so.
So Bound and Turner may come up with their result. On the other hand, you sort of take a naive look at the data and the evidence, and it's not clear. Degrees should be falling off because tuition on average has increased enormously.
Well, the issue there is we're not observing the counterfactual. What would have happened if tuition had not gone up? There's at least some evidence which suggests we would have even more college degrees than we're getting now. So college enrollments are increasing and more people are getting college degrees, but is that because we're raising tuition? Well, probably not any more than, you know, it rained on the last three Thursdays doesn't mean it's going to rain on the next Thursday. That just because we have a correlation there doesn't mean one's causing the other. Anyway, that's, I am trying to study that specific issue in more depth. I'm working on that now because it's absolutely a crucial issue. In fact, I think it's the most crucial issue for all of this. I've tried to deal with various things, and I think I've dealt with most of them fairly well. But establishing really convincing evidence that there's a causal impact of public support, I think, is the crucial one to be answered.
Yeah, no, one thing, we don't have crystal clear data on this, but there's a lot of anecdotal data showing that over the last 40 years, the composition of enrollment has changed on the Madison campus, for example. That, you know, now their income, many more, higher proportion of higher income kids attending here than 40 years ago. So although the enrollment hasn't dropped, the composition may have changed, you know, to a fairly dramatic degree.
You raise a really important point, which I'm not addressing at all in this study, and that is, where can we maximize the bang for our buck? And it's pretty clear if we target the students who wouldn't go to college otherwise, that's where we really get the benefit. That a lot of the money that we're putting into higher education isn't helping those who wouldn't be there otherwise. So, you know, I wish I could really quantify that we target the money better. This is our return as opposed to what our average return is. But that's a whole other study.
I was just curious, and I may have just missed the number, but you have the net present value is $182,000 for a college graduate. How does that compare to the just high school or associate degree?
Well, that's a good question. First, I didn't estimate anything to do with lower levels of education, just to confine the scope of the analysis. It turns out it's easier to do for college graduates because you're closer to their ultimate outcomes. That, for example, if I want to look at high school graduates, much of the return to high school is the fact that they go to college. So disentangling that effect's a lot more difficult. So I've chosen the easy way out. It's difficult to say whether or not this return is bigger or smaller than for high school. But I would be shocked if there wasn't at least a comparable return to low levels of education. Does that answer
your
question?
I was just curious, you know, if you're listening. So.
Well, a couple things, sort of a follow-up. I thought you said earlier that there was a 40% drop in public funding leading to a 40% less degrees in one example in one of your earlier slides. Just go over that. And the broader issue I want to look at is well, Europe, it's almost a right to education and healthcare, you know, is standard in Europe. And it's standard to give us people feel they have a right to education K through 12, but isn't the college degree becoming the new high school degree, and shouldn't that be standard funding as well? I mean, what's the percentage of population going on to college these days? It might be comparable to people going on to high school 100 years ago or something like that. I'm not sure what the exact numbers are, but those are the issues I'd like to raise, comment on.
Okay, I'll start with the last one because that's the one I remember. you raise a very legitimate point, but something that I don't really haven't quantified to any extent. But certainly the average educational expectation has been increasing. And so you could certainly make the argument that whereas a high school graduate was needed to reach this status two generations ago, now you need a college degree. But the one thing I'd like to add to that is that we're not playing a zero-sum game. And it's not just a matter of getting this credential to reach middle class or upper middle class. That the earnings premium doesn't shrink as we get more college graduates. So it's not just a matter of, I want to be in the 75 percentile, I need this qualification. Even if the lower end raises their qualification, they get higher earnings. Raise the upper end, they get higher earnings. So it's not, we don't have a zero-sum game here where we're trying to claw for position. So the fact that the average educational attainment and expectation are increasing doesn't mean we're not getting anywhere. So we're getting more education, but we're actually getting more prosperity from that, not just a greater hurdle to jump over. Now, what was the first thing you asked again? Because that was an interesting question, but I forgot what it was.
40-40, the earlier slide, where you showed public funding right. And degrees going down 40%
yeah.
Each.
Yeah, let me qualify that, because I went through it pretty quickly. First, that's somebody else's research, so I don't want to, okay. You know, put too many words in their mouth. But the time period, gosh, I don't remember. I don't think it was a long time ago. And I know they looked over a number of years, so I suspect it was in the last couple of decades, those data. What they're looking at in there, those 40% numbers, are the consequences, and we have to be really careful about this interpretation, the consequences of a relative increase in the number of high school graduates. So suppose Wisconsin had this cohort of young people coming up that we had 100,000, or that's too big, 50,000 more high school graduates than we usually do. So that's going to put strain on the higher education system. What are the consequences of having this extra 50,000 potential students? What they have showed is that funding will increase. Funding for higher education will increase because we have more people, more students. But funding doesn't go up by the same proportion that the number of students or potential number of students is going up. And in fact, the relationship is 40%. Or 40%. Funding goes up by, for every 50,000 students, funding goes up by 60%. So if that were a 10% increase in the number of high school graduates, funding would only go up by 6%. So funding per student goes down by 4%. Evidently, as a consequence of that, 4 years later, the proportion of those high school graduates is 40% lower than it would have been otherwise. If we had the usual status quo, the same number of high school graduates coming out per year, but instead we get this extra 50,000, instead of the proportion being, say, 30%, it's going to be 40% less than that. Does that make sense? So
those are marginal rates, the 40%.
Exactly right. So they're not. That's not a historical episode. That's just the average marginal effect. So it's trying to establish what the counterfactual would be. There's essentially a natural experiment created through demographic changes, and that's what they're using to identify this marginal effect.
Any other questions or comments?
One other question about if the rate of return is, or the return on the investment is much greater at the federal level than the states. According to our system, the states are responsible for education and the federal government has relatively recently become mm-hmm. heavily involved. So when you calculate this, aren't the states acting as agents of the federal government, you know, what in their efforts, so that you should count, the return isn't just, it's return to the total rather than differentiating between state and federal. I don't know, that's a complicated idea, but it's this originally, and it's still an issue politically, should there be a federal Department of Education, and that was created against a lot of resistance mm-hmm. and efforts to cut it back and all that stuff, but still the demand, policy has moved to the federal government because it plays a necessary role in coordinating things. But still, it's not as if we had one. If we were to design the system over again, is this fact that the states are the agents, are supposed to provide education, a factor that affects what the conclusions we draw from what you presented?
Absolutely. I think these numbers make a pretty strong case that the relative role of the federal government should be greater. Economists like to look at how people respond to incentives, and the states don't have nearly the same incentive to invest in higher education as the whole country does. So if you want to create efficient incentives, you need to match up the benefits to who's paying the cost, and clearly that's not what this is showing. So I think there's a very strong case that there needs to be a larger federal role, at least in the financing. So, you know, so
we need revenue sharing. The feds send money back to the states because we're giving them this huge rate of return.
And if we wanted to appeal to conservatives who might be against giving institutions, you know, throwing a lot more money at them, I think you can make a very strong case. Well, okay, let's not give the money to institutions. Let's just increase federal financial aid. Pick up more of these $481,000 bills by any student who can't get a college degree for financial reasons. Let's eliminate that.
Someone mentioned Europe as a potential model. I come from Europe, so I would like to discourage you to go that way. because 80% of funding to public universities go from state. It's almost constitutional right, as you said, to go on to college. Unfortunately, only for those who may be funded from the state. So 50% of those who apply are rejected. So do you want to go that way? So the other suggestion here was increase tuition fees. Why not? But then tuition fee should be completely tax deductible. And then it will work. So it will still, the state, federal, or local will not get the money back, but in fact, students will be, and parents will be able to invest more. Mm-hmm. So there are two, I mean, there are two extremes. Mm-hmm. Europe, I would not recommend to go that way. And of course, tuition fees may be increased, but then tax deductible.
Yeah, couple great points. First, I've worked in Europe, and I agree. I wouldn't suggest that route because although you might not have to pay for your higher education, getting in is a lot more difficult. So there's a lot more selection going on. I'm not sure that's where we want to go. What
else?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Certainly, you could also make a very strong economic argument that we should raise tuition, get rid of the public subsidy for the students and their families, but target all the aid on those who otherwise wouldn't go. And it's a very compelling case, and I agree completely with what you're saying. Another way we could go about that, I'm not sure that would create enough of an incentive. That you could probably use evidence of this sort to suggest that not only should we be making tuition tax deductible, but we need to provide a subsidy just to will pay you to go to school. And I mean, I'm speculating a little bit because you have to go through the entire calculus. But I suspect just making it free tuition for those who wouldn't otherwise go might not be enough to really pick up all these $481,000 bills.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Phil Trostel. We'll take a small break and begin at 11, which is the last question was a good segue to Professor Ed St. John, who will begin at 11. So if you take a break, and we'll start again at 11 a.m. Thank you.